Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. The clerk will call the first case.
St. John et al. Versus Thompson et al. William D. Ashwell, Appellant's Counsel. Nate L. Adams III, Appellee's Counsel. If IT will bring in Mr. Ashwell and Mr. Adams. Please allow 30 seconds for transfer.
All right. Mr. Ashwell?
Good morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is William Ashwell, and I am counsel on behalf of the appellants James Charles St. John JCS Trust. I would ask at this time to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
The appellants are here today asking for a reversal of the Clark County Circuit Court's final order granting rescission to the subject firearms transfer to the JCS Trust by Ernest Elsie and the Ernest Elsie Trust, and additionally the award of attorney's fees granted by the trial court based in Prospect Development versus Bershader. For the court are the two assignments of error particular to the underlying issues central to the final order, that is the trial court's application of the Bershader decision in granting attorney's fees, and second, the basis of the rescission of the subject firearms based on the Elsie Trust, adduced in evidence as in existence and at some time having an ownership interest in the subject firearms, not being made party to the litigation. The main issue that we have before the court today is that issue related to Bershader and its progeny. As the court is well aware, we operate under the American rule related to attorney's fees in which they are recoverable for a litigant only in the event of a contract or in the event of a statute. Of course, the Bershader case somewhat changed that landscape and created through case law the ability in a fraud landscape for a litigant to recoup attorney's fees. I think one of the problems that continues to exist, which is natural from decisions like Bershader, is knowing the appropriate application and the expansion in scope of an award of attorney's fees, like this situation, based in a representation or an allegation of fraud. As the court appropriately noted in that decision, when deciding whether to award attorney's fees, the chancellor or fact finder must consider the circumstances surrounding the fraudulent act and the nature of the relief granted to the defrauded party, setting up more or less a baseline in which the court or the fact finder is to consider the fact and circumstances before it in fashioning an award. As the Fourth Circuit highlighted in CF Trust Inc. versus First Light, kind of an outside review of that decision from this court, I think the concern is in how to really apply that standard and whether or not, as these attorney's fees and these case law-driven creations of attorney's fees awards are to be narrowly construed, which I believe they are. Under the circumstances of this particular case, and I think what gives this court an opportunity to truly both distinguish Bershader and apply it in a different scenario than those facts underlying the Bershader decision. When we dealt with Prospect Development in that particular case, this court made a particular set of findings that rendered it appropriate to award attorney's fees. That was, quote, callous, deliberate, deceitful acts. That was perpetrated by the developer in that particular case over a very long period of time and through several very specific fraudulent transactions. Quite simply, in the instant case, that's simply not something that's substantiated in the record. By and large, the trial court in this case rests its entire theory of liability in rescission of this transfer of the subject firearms In paragraph 14 of what's called the findings of fact and conclusions of law, a pleading that's somewhat specific to Clark County and the district, in finding more or less several factual summaries that's adopted by the court, that it's the appellant's position, quite simply, is not supported by the record. In fact, it's our belief that they are, in fact, contradicted by the record, and in specifically the deposition testimony in a limited degree by Mr. Elsie used at trial. In paragraph 14, which again serves as the main basis for the trial court's finding that some sort of fraud took place in granting the rescission, states that several representations were made by Mr. St. John, Mr. Elsie, which are not in the record, that did not occur. Then under the circumstances, there were allegations that the appellants herein made suggestions to Mr. Elsie concerning placement in a nursing home that is also not in the record. And in fact, quite the contrary, was testified to by Mr. Elsie in his deposition, was his concern. So in this particular case, we have a situation in where we do have to do somewhat of a deep dive into the record on appeal to see whether or not there is anything to substantiate the decision of the trial court. And I would put forth to this court that there is not that factual support for the end game of the trial court. There's several examples since Bershader, including Devine versus Buki and some other similar cases in which the court upheld awards of attorney's fees for specific deceitful conduct, usually with what I would call the condition precedent fraud, meaning that when the actors came together, there was a substantive, particular representation in which the litigant never intended to fulfill, was untrue at the time it was made, versus a situation where there is a promise that cannot be or is not later fulfilled, which, as this court knows, is most likely what ends up in every case as a contract dispute. And we have to
walk that line. Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a question.
Absolutely.
Are you trying to say that promissory fraud can never constitute the degree of fraud sufficient for an equitable award of attorney's fees? Or are you saying that this particular promissory fraud case was not at the level of severity? Because you realize we didn't grant the writ on whether or not promissory fraud was proven. That's not really before us. So can you clarify exactly where you're surgically entering this subject and telling us what you want us to do?
I can, Your Honor, and that is a very appropriate application in looking at these two assignments of error that were granted. And that, Your Honor, is absolutely right. When looking at, I think it's the latter point that Your Honor quoted, in looking at the degree, scale, and conduct that was proven in determining whether or not to award those attorney's fees, I think would be my focus. And again, looking at Bershader and kind of the general landscape of guidance is the consideration of the circumstances of the fraudulent act. So I think in looking at and analyzing that particular landscape and determining in my discussion concerning the record, I think Your Honor is correct. You know, we're not in a situation of reviewing at this juncture the tribunal's determination as to fraud. I think it has to be the latter on whether or not, given that finding, which I think bootstraps into this finding by the court considering paragraph 14, is this something under the circumstances in which an award of attorney's fees is appropriate? And as this court knows, there are several other circumstances and cases in which, of course, the court found that they were not. So under the circumstances here, I think in juggling that, based on the review of what's before the court today, I think a pretty hard look at the record is appropriate in determining whether or not there was an abuse of discretion here, or whether or not there was an inappropriate application and award of attorney's fees here, both, I believe, in the threshold of making an attorney's fees award under Bershader, and then second, I think it bootstraps in the actual award that was granted by the court, kind of a two-pronged approach That is the calculation in which the court undertook in deciding to grant attorney's fees, which is discussed at length in the brief itself.
May I interrupt you again, counsel, with
yes,
a similar
sir.
Question? Is the issue you're presenting to us whether or not attorney's fees under the proper standard can be awarded or cannot be awarded, or is it actually the calculation of the fee? Because much in the brief dealt with, you know, measuring certain tasks and what was duplicative and what was irrelevant. Was any of that really addressed in the trial court level, at the trial court level?
Thank you,
the
Your
latter
Honor.
Part?
To answer you the last question, Your Honor, I believe the answer is no. Substantively, what we had was the submission of affidavits, very limited argument, almost no decision by the trial court on the record concerning that amount and those fees, and truthfully, what I would call a passing glance in reference to the Chawla Burger Busters case and the application of the applicable factors, which I would put forth, did not actually occur. So to answer Your Honor's question, I believe it's a two-pronged analysis, at least from where the appellants sit, in whether or not there is that threshold being met in order to award attorney's fees under Bruchader. And then second, if the court for some, you know, were to say yes, and that that's essentially something that comes with a trial court's finding of fraud regardless, then I think it triggers that second part of saying, are we going to, in the situation of a multi-count complaint versus multiple parties where one cause of action was ultimately granted judgment against only two of those parties, are we going to permit the plaintiff at trial to essentially, with the court's blessing, obtain all of their attorney's fees in their entirety without any particularity or showing as to the actual fraud count? Because what we can have is situations where litigants will plead multi-count, and if they have several causes of action, of course, that do not have, I think we're creating a problem under the circumstances of not parsing out and requiring a litigant to establish what is applicable attorney's fees for the fraud count, which is the actual basis of that award in the first place. So under the circumstances, Your Honor, I think it's both would be applicable for what we have here today. I think based on, unless there's any other questions, I see I've got about 3 minutes and 20 seconds. It might be an appropriate time to reserve the balance for rebuttal.
All right, 3 minutes and 14 seconds. Mr. Adams.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Nate Adams and I represent the appellee, Laura Thompson, the executive of the estate of Ernest Stewart Elsie. Once the trial court made a finding of actual fraud in this case, at that point, the opportunity for attorney's fees to be awarded under the Prospect Development Company versus Bruchader case arose. And the standard for that is simply that in its discretion, the court may award attorney's fees to a defrauded party. And when deciding whether to award the attorney's fees, they must consider the circumstances surrounding the fraudulent acts and the nature of the relief granted to the defrauded party. In that particular case, the defendants engaged in what was called callous, deliberate, deceitful acts resulting in a pattern of misconduct. When you have a finding of actual fraud, there's already deliberate, deceitful acts that lead to that conclusion. This court affirmed that finding with regard to the finding of actual fraud when it denied the assignment of error prepared by Mr. St. John. So at this point, there's a discretion of the court as to whether to award attorney's fees. That issue was addressed in argument on August 14th, in which we went through the various record and what it showed insofar as what the callous, deliberate, deceitful acts were. And there's a litany of those acts, whether it's taking advantage of Mr. Elsie, who suffered from cognitive deficits at the time that he suffered the suicide death of his brother, and he was in a state of despondency, subject to undue influence. Mr. St. John was aware of this, and the court found that to be the case. In addition, St. John knew that he was suffering from diminished capacity, subject to undue influence. So what did he do? He said, look, if you give me the firearms, I'll make sure that your family doesn't get them, which is a very concern of Mr. Elsie's, and I'll make sure that they don't put you into a nursing home, which Mr. Elsey found to be abhorrent. So then, what else are the deceitful acts, the deliberate acts that occurred? Well, he obtains a power of attorney. He utilizes the power of attorney to find estate planning documents, a will, a trust with regard to Mr. Elsey. He revises those. He makes himself and Catherine Cole a beneficiary under those documents. He makes himself a fiduciary under those documents. And he doesn't tell the estate planning attorney who was working with Mr. Elsey. He doesn't advise the estate planning attorney or anyone about the transfer of the firearms that occurred. And in fact, he tries to terminate the relationship between that attorney and Mr. Elsey. Then he finds that there's a second, he finds the Elsey Trust. And he thinks, well, maybe, just maybe, there might probably be a transfer of firearms to that. So what he does then is he prepares a second transfer, saying that I probably think that there's going to be a transfer of firearms to these, so therefore I'm going to go ahead and ask that you sign this. And he has Mr. Elsey sign these documents in front of a notary public without reading them or otherwise letting him know what they are in front of the notary. So you have a situation where this fraud continues, and the trial court specifically found that Mr. St. John maintained the fraud, and that's what led to the increase in the attorney's fees in this case. And that was found in the breach of fiduciary duty count. And what he did was, after all these transfers took place, Mr. St. John attempted to have a conservator guardian appointed for Mr. Elsey, which would have locked in the state. After the power of attorney was in fact revoked in favor of Mr. Elsey in November of 2016, he still tries to have, through Mr. Patton and another attorney who assisted with the conservatorship, another power of attorney. In 2017, when it comes to light that something's wrong here, there's a problem, and Mr. Hobart writes a letter to St. John saying, look, we see this document saying that there's a JCS trust involved. What are the obligations of Mr. Elsey under this trust? What are the assets of this trust? Instead of returning the firearms, what Mr. St. John does at that particular time is to revoke Mr. Elsey's status as subordinate trustee, leaving him no possibility of recovering those particular assets. So then you have the situation where Mr. St. John says, well, look, if Mr. Elsey had come to me directly and asked for the return, I would have returned them. But he knew, and the court found, that he was capable of being influenced, that he had limited skills, and that St. John did not consider the complaint which was filed in this case to be that type of request that was signed by Mr. Elsey. So he never returned the firearms. So it was within the court's discretion to decide whether these were the types of acts, the fraud, the maintaining of the fraud, that should result in an award of attorney's fees under Prospect Development versus Burschader. Now, what Mr. St. John is now saying is, well, you know what? There may be good fraud or narrow fraud, but that's never been the case. Essentially, what the standard is, you take a look at the deceit, the deliberate acts, the callous acts, and the court properly considered that, and there's been no allegation and abuse of discretion with regard to factors that should have been considered that weren't, factors that were considered that were outside the scope, or just error of judgment. So then you move on to the amount of attorney's fees. That was argued, and we went through the amount of the attorney's fees by affidavit, as directed by the trial court. Mr. Ashwell had the opportunity to contest several entries. I believe he contested about 5 entries over a 2-year period. The court had the opportunity to review that, heard counsel for Mr. Elsey indicate what those consisted of. Then, and most importantly, the court applied the Burger Buster analysis in terms of the reasonableness of attorney's fees. So the reasonableness of attorney's fees, utilizing the 7 factors, he recited that, he considered that, those were all part of the process in terms of an award of attorney's fees. So in my point is simply that there's never been a designated abuse of process or abuse of discretion that's been clarified, identified for purposes of this appeal. Now, in terms of what should happen in this case, I'll tell you, if there's a formula out there, this court certainly has not utilized such a formula, because we still are left with burger busters and the factors to be considered in the reasonableness of attorney's fees.
Mr. Adams, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may direct your attention to the other assignment of error, the absence of the LC Trust, could you address that briefly?
Right. The absence of the LC Trust. First of all, there was a fact by the trial court that Mr. LC individually owned the firearms. This was done through testimony from Mr. St. John in his video deposition, as well as his oral transcript that was submitted. It was in response, Mr. Elsey testified that they were his firearms when asked by Mr. Ashwell during his deposition. So at that point, there's evidence that Mr. Elsey owns the firearms. There's never been any testimony identified by Mr. Ashwell or Mr. St. John saying that Mr. Elsey didn't own it. What they're pointing to are documents that are related to the transfer of firearms that may have been owned by the LC Trust to this particular JCS Trust. There, the rationale and the purpose for that particular transfer in April of 2016 had to do with Mr. St. John's concern that I have found a trust that Mr. LC has. I don't know whether or not any firearms have been transferred to that. Probably have been, I don't know, and therefore I'm going to make sure, as like an anticipatory breach, an anticipatory an attempt to have any firearms there transferred just in case. But there was never any evidence presented that the trust owned it. In fact, you know, the trust was actually never introduced as part of this case. So for to make findings saying, well, wait a minute, you know, the trust owned this based upon this document. There was never any evidence that when the trust was formed, that it had been funded. The trust was prepared by Mr. Trubin, who was called as a witness by Mr. St. John, or at least subpoenaed as a witness. He wasn't called, and you'll see that there's a stipulation in terms of what the evidence would be that Trubin would testify to. Had nothing to do with the trust. Had nothing to do with whether the trust had been funded. It was simply whether or not Mr. Trubin relied on the power of attorney in order to provide estate planning documents. So there's a complete absence of any type of facts that would support any type of ownership of the guns by the trust. Furthermore, I believe that that's outside the scope of the assignment of error, because essentially what the court has asked us to do in this particular case is to identify whether there was relief provided to the LC Trust that was not a party to the case. When you take a look at the final order involved in this, the court found Mr. LC individually owned the firearms. The court fashioned the relief, setting aside the transfer by Mr. LC individually to the JCS Trust and the St. John. When it came to the LC Trust, there is an absence of any relief in the final order, the findings of fact, conclusions of law, that provide any relief to the LC Trust. So from my perspective, the assignment of error that was raised by Mr. St. John is it just doesn't follow. So we have shown that specifically that there is no evidence that supports the LC Trust being an owner, being entitled to any relief, or being afforded any relief under the terms of the trial court. So when you have these standards that are to be used by the court, there aren't any facts that have been identified that are absolutely wrong or an error. With regard to the discretion of the court in deciding whether to award attorney's fees, or whether to decide the amount of the attorney's fees. And actually, I think the amount of the attorney's fees is also outside the assignment of error because of the fact that when the assignment of error was granted, it had to do with whether there should be an award, not whether there should be an award and whether the amount awarded was incorrect or not. But we believe that as a result of the fact that there has been no identifiable finding of fact placing the LC Trust as the owner of the firearms, and that there is no relief given, that should be denied that particular assignment of error. With regard to the award of the attorney's fees, there's been no indication that, in fact, there's been any type of abuse of discretion. And we talk about the Buckeye case. You know, that had to do with transfers and causes of action. So to the extent that they are asking for a formula, that was a case in which there was fraud in the inducement, breach of contract, Virginia Consumer Protection Act. At the trial court level, the plaintiff lost Virginia Consumer Protection Act, lost the case against the defendant's wife. On appeal to the Virginia Supreme Court, they lost the consequential damages. And the Virginia Supreme Court didn't say, okay, you only get 40% of your attorney's fees. It's still a reasonable attorney's fee standard under the Burger Buster case. With regard to the Carlson case, that had to do with a breach of fiduciary duty, and it wasn't fraud. That was a UTMA custodian who took money, commingled it, failed to provide accountings, and engaged in speculative investments. There, the court determined that even though the custodian resigned after the filing of the complaint, repaid a substantial portion of the money, provided an accounting afterwards, after the complaint had been filed, that still Prospect Development versus Bershader allowed attorney's fees to be assessed against him. So if that's good fraud, then the Prospect Development still applies to in the full leverage with the deliberate, callous, deceitful acts. So we would respectfully request that the trial court's award of the attorney's fees and the amount of the attorney's fees be affirmed. We would ask that the petition, the assignment of error, number 5, be denied. And we have asked that there be a remand for the consideration of additional attorney's fees at the trial court level. Thank you.
Mr. Ashwell, you have 3 minutes, 14 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think, counsel's identified appropriately, that the court can find actual fraud based in Bershader, permits and opens the door to attorney's fees. But that isn't the end of the analysis. And candidly, I think counsel's proffer of the facts here would not pass muster with a diligent review of the record. And you really only have to go so far as the finding of facts and conclusions of law. All of those things represented as far as constituting this deceitful continued acts is nowhere to be found in the trial court's decision that's reduced to specific writing in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Under the fraud count, in paragraph 2 in that document, there is only one paragraph that discusses the court's consideration for fraud. And this is unique because when we talk about whether or not we have error, whether or not there's a decision of the trial court that constitutes error, this particular court chooses to reduce it to writing, to say, this is what we considered in rendering that award. The only thing considered by this court is an alleged false representation of material fact intended to mislead, that he held firearms for family, for his assets, for safekeeping if he placed them in a nursing home. All of the things which we have pled and the record substantiates was a concern of the litigant. So the point here is that counsel can argue, anyone can argue whatever they want, but the trial court here and the record is where we look to what was actually substantiated related to this fraud. And as we know from
Mr. Ashwell, this is Justice Kelsey again. Mr. Ashwell, if you're wrong and if fees were appropriate, what's your response to the request for a remand for consideration of appellate fees?
I'm not aware of any authority to do that. And under the circumstances, I think based under where we are and having these particular assignments granted, that would not be an appropriate response. Based under the circumstances. We're already here and we know, for example, that Bershader is a unique creature that's developed from case law, not having any authority by statute, rule, or contract, so there would be no authority for a remand for additional attorney's fees, Your Honor. And under the circumstances, we get back to kind of where Bershader left us, which is, again, when we're talking about it, and the rubber meets the road to some degree when we get to the Chawla analysis, but the only mandate the trial court has is that they must consider circumstances and the nature of the relief. And I think in this particular case, I think despite the contention made in argument, a review of the record at the hearing referenced by counsel where the presentation of the affidavit, and then in the conclusory finding that everything in this affidavit will be awarded, here you go, there is not a substantive analysis under Trollenberger Busters. And second, on the record, there's not a, I believe, consideration of the circumstances and nature of relief as intended in Burschader. So we'd ask that that award be vacated. And I see my time has expired, and I thank the court very much.
All right, thank you very much.